It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker. Rob Ferret is out this week. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank joins us to talk about the state budget and proposed changes to tenure. First, in one of the most highly anticipated decisions in some time, the United States Supreme Court has sided with the Obama administration, upholding a key part of the Affordable Care Act. In a 6-3 decision, the court said the federal government can give subsidies to those participating in both federal and state exchanges. The case represents the second time the court has backed the health care law, and our next guest says that's great news for Wisconsin. Robert Craig is here with us now to talk about that decision. He's the executive director of Citizens Action of Wisconsin. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Great to be with you.
I want to start by taking a listen to what President Obama had to say this morning regarding that decision.
And today, after more than 50 votes in Congress to repeal or weaken this law, after a presidential election based in part on preserving or repealing this law, after multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay.
President, sounding pretty secure there as he makes some remarks this morning. Robert, considering all the twists and turns that we've taken to get here, how significant is today's ruling for the president's signature law?
Very significant, because this, if this ruling had gone the other way, it would have yanked health care coverage away from millions of people and 184,000 people in Wisconsin. This particular legal case came as a surprise. So we thought the legal issues had been resolved a couple of years ago with the first Supreme Court ruling. It seems like, unless there's something unanticipated, that the whole legal strategy here of conservatives to undermine and sabotage the law is at an end. And the only real thing to look forward to is if the 2016 election turns out to have full Republican control in Congress. That seems to be the last hurdle for this health care reform law.
Well, to look at the core of what this case was about, subsidies were at the heart of King versus Burwell. What exactly was being challenged here by critics of the law? What was the language that they were taking issue with?
Well, some folks at a right-wing think tank, the Cato Institute, thought they found a drafting error where there's some language that refers to state-created marketplaces and not federal. Most states have chosen to go the route of having the federal government set up the marketplace. The issue there was that a state like Wisconsin that had a federal marketplace, everyone on the new marketplace would have lost their subsidies if the court had gone the other way. So we're talking about 184,000 people, a lot of them with pre-existing conditions, a lot of them without good insurance at work, working for small businesses, or people who are forced off voucher care, like Governor Walker, would have lost their affordable health coverage. And if you look at Wisconsin, the whole country, that would have been absolutely devastating. The problem is it makes no sense. Congress didn't intend it. No state, when they chose to set up a federal marketplace rather than a state one, thought they were making that decision. And as Justice Roberts said the day in the decision, it would have devastated the entire health insurance market nationally as well, which could not have been the intent. And so basically the majority, including two conservatives, Kennedy and Roberts, decided that the lawsuit made no sense and you couldn't make sense of what Congress did and believe this interpretation. So it's really important because some people thought they'd leave it vague and leave it to the next president, leave it to the IRS to interpret. This says that the subsidies go to everyone in every state, whether their state created its own marketplace or participated in the federal marketplace. So this is a resounding decision.
It was interesting because some people saw drafting error, and in that error, some people said, well, maybe you can look at the intent of the law, but you could also argue that this was something that was intended to incentivize states.
Those were all kind of after-the-fact arguments, because you may remember when we in Wisconsin argued for a Wisconsin state exchange and lost that debate with Governor Walker, but no one at the time said we'd be giving up subsidies. In fact, if we healthcare advocates in the state of Wisconsin thought that, we would have made that argument at the time. So it's something that's completely created in the case that was never thought by Congress, never thought by any governor or state legislature when they were making that decision.
So there were six justices who supported, three dissenting. Scalia had quite a lot to say about this, and some of his stuff was actually apparently raised some eyebrows. People thought it was a little funny. What did Scalia say?
Well, Scalia, it's interesting because he has in the past taken the position that intent of Congress is most important, not how a bill is actually drafted. But he seems He seems to want to undermine the Affordable Care Act at any point. There are a lot of people who are concerned that even though he does have a lot of legal credentials, he's becoming a very political justice. And so he is essentially saying that the other conservative justices, along with the moderates and liberals on the court, are kind of making the law rational when it wasn't. And so they should have just thrown out the subsidies and thrown it back to Congress based on that drafting error. I don't think that's reasonable, and that's certainly not the way the courts in general have looked at laws. They look at it very important. In fact, many justices believe, and legal scholars, that you have to look at the intent of a law, not just how you could construct various pieces of language in a 1,000-page bill.
And he sort of also pointed out that the Supreme Court had backed the Affordable Care Act before. I think he has at one point said that we should be calling it SCOTUS care. So some interesting things going on of today's decision. We're talking with Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin, talking about his perspective on today's Supreme Court ruling in favor of the Affordable Care Act. And speaking of Wisconsin, again, a state that opted to use the federal exchange as opposed to setting up a state-specific exchange. Had this gone the other way, what do you think would have happened, both in Wisconsin and other states like Wisconsin? How big a deal would that have been?
Well, it's interesting you would ask, because there are a lot of people beginning to believe this would have been a political nightmare for governors like Scott Walker and for conservative members of Congress, because it would have been on them to deny health care to their own constituents. And so Governor Walker had been taking this position that he would do nothing. It's a congressional problem. It's a president's problem. He wrote an op-ed yesterday about that, saying it's all the president's fault and he wouldn't do anything. It would have, most people believe a governor would have a responsibility to deal with a disaster such as that, especially when there are easy solutions the state could take. But it's now not on his plate now that the Supreme Court has upheld the law. I think it would have reset the whole health care debate. We would have really understood when people lost their health coverage why we need health care reform in the first place. But even not facing that disaster, I think this whole run-up, this whole year of discussion of this case has actually changed the health care debate and has helped remind people why we need health care reform in the first place, why there needs to be a place for anyone to get affordable health care who needs it no matter what, that can't be taken away no matter what.
Do you think that politically some Republicans are relieved that this isn't something that has to be dealt with, the aftermath of a decision that would have gone their way?
I think that's absolutely the case. There's been a lot of press coverage about that the last month or two. It started in a trickle. We actually predicted in December that we thought this would be a political disaster for opponents of health care reform. So, yeah, there's a lot of speculation that even though Scott Walker came out today and called for further pushes to repeal the law, and even though Speaker Boehner was outspoken against the decision, that a number of conservative leaders and Republican leaders across the country are relieved they don't have to face a crisis and be put in a position of saying no to their own constituents and taking their health care away.
And yet, the Republicans saying this, they may need to fight harder. Do you see that?
Well, I wish that we could move beyond this. I think the president is right that the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land and we need to move forward and build on it. I'm very concerned that there are all sorts of additional improvements we need to make in the law and in our health care system. We have to get at cost. In Wisconsin, we need to accept the Badger Care money because there are a lot of low-income people being denied affordable coverage right now because of that decision. But instead of talking about how we build on the law.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. It was Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin, joined us to talk about his perspective on today's ruling in favor of the Affordable Care Act. Tenure for college professors at the UW system has been up for debate in Wisconsin after changes in the proposed state budget called for the removal of tenure protections from state statute. An additional proposal would allow faculty to be dismissed due to budget issues or changes to academic programs that are, quote, deemed necessary. Wisconsin has until now been the only state to include tenure in state law, and some University of Wisconsin leaders are promising to write new tenure protections into university policy if it goes away from state statute. UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank joins us now to talk about the future of tenure. Chancellor Blank, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Well, what was your first reaction when you heard about the changes to tenure that the legislature was proposing?
So this was not entirely a surprise. If we're talking about taking the tenure definitions out of state law and putting them into regional policy, because, of course, the earlier proposal for an independent authority for the system would have had the same effect. And I was very pleased when that proposal was given within a week. The Board of Regents at their June meeting voted unanimously to adopt as their policy exactly the same language as had existed in statute. So my concern about tenure per se is completely alleviated by that. Almost all of our fellow schools have tenure in regional policy. This simply puts us on a level playing field with all of them.
So you're saying that originally when the proposal came for the university to become a public authority, tenure language was also going to be stripped in that version?
Yes, the part of the statute that defines all the things for the university would have disappeared if we'd become a public authority, and it would have been up to the regents as the head of the public authority to put all of that language or whatever form of it they wanted back in place. You know, one of the things that's really annoyed me is a number of national and international publications which have written stories with the headline, University of Wisconsin Abolishes Tenure, and that's simply wrong. The proposal is to take it out of state statute and have it exist in region authority, but that's the way every other university in this country operates, and we're not abolishing tenure. We're just going on to the same process that all of our peers have.
What about the language that is proposed to be added saying that layoffs could be accomplished due to changes to academic programs that are deemed necessary because of budget issues or other things that may come up? Some faculty are worried that that leaves an opening for backdoor layoffs that could step on the toes of academic freedom. Do you think that's a legitimate concern?
Yes, and this was the surprise, was the inclusion of language about faculty layoffs into new proposed state statute that hadn't been there before, that was essentially the language the regents have used around staff layoffs, adapted, you know, almost verbatim to apply to faculty. And for tenured faculty, that's not appropriate. And I understand the upset of my faculty around that. It essentially suggests you can lay off faculty for relatively minor program changes. Now, let me be clear, and I've been saying this across campus, this is not directive language. It doesn't say when you make a modern modification in a program, you've got to lay off the faculty member. It is what's called authorizing language. It says, you could do this, but you decide. You know, Board of Regents and different universities, what you want to do. And what you immediately do is you write administrative policy around this authorizing language, indicating the circumstances under which, when you close programs, you would, if ever, consider terminating tenured faculty and the process you would follow. So we're in the midst of looking at how we would write such language. I am quite confident we can write language that essentially is very comparable to our peers, in which, you know, all of whom have statutory, you know, have various policy language through their boards, indicating when program closures would lead to a consideration of faculty tenure and the whole process you follow at that point.
But wouldn't the state statute, the language in the omnibus, override the university's language?
Well, no, there's nothing directive here. It doesn't say anything that you must do this. There is state language occasionally that says you must run such a program and you must do this. This language simply says the Board of Regents has the authority to consider faculty layoffs under this variety of situations. The Board of Regents can choose when they utilize that authority or not, and can write the policies that indicate, you know, here are the sorts of program closures that would lead us to think about faculty layoffs, and here's the process we would follow. So here at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, you know, we have a set of peers who we have to be identical to because, you know, my faculty are going to want jobs that are equivalent of the jobs they'd have at Michigan or Iowa or Illinois. And, you know, we would write language that would essentially say it's relative, you know, only major program closures would we undertake this authority. And under those circumstances, we would almost surely look at all options before we'd consider ending tenure, and all options mean things like moving faculty into other departments. This is what every first-rate research and educational institution does when they close things, is, you know, if you're closing a geography department, you move faculty into sociology or into urban studies or into something else. And you see this happen at other places. You very rarely eliminate faculty tenure because it's a very important concept. It's not something you play with lightly.
And even given that, it would, though, it sounds like, be an option, a choice on the table.
Not if you have strong policy saying, here are the circumstances under which we take up this authority. No. You know, it, again, this is exactly identical to our peers. Our peers have this all in original authority that outline when they would, under a circumstance of a program closure, look at what's happening to faculty and when they would consider reviewing any tenure issues. And our regents would adopt similar policy.
Now, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been critical of tenure in the past, saying it shouldn't be permanent job protection. It shouldn't be a job for life. What do you make of that critique?
Well, I personally think that thinking about tenure as a job for life is the wrong way to think about it. There's two strong arguments for tenure, one substantive, one more a competitive economic argument. The substantive argument is that this is about protecting the free exchange of ideas. Tenure for tenured faculty, and let me note, to get to be a tenured faculty, you go through a very long and extended process of evaluation, and lots of people don't make it through that, okay? But once you get there, it says whatever you want to research, whatever you want to write about, you can't be fired for the topics that you pick. And particularly in public universities, there's always unhappiness about someone doing something that somebody out there in the public sphere doesn't like. And it's protection against that, which is incredibly important if you're going to be a first-rate university with a free flow and exchange of ideas. So this is about freedom of ideas, not jobs for life. Secondly, let me make the competitive argument. Whether you like tenure or not, okay, every one of our competitors offer it. And if we stopped offering tenure at this university or offered tenure with very limited tenure protection where you could fire faculty easily, I would lose all my top faculty. And my faculty have the reputation of this university. You know, they would go to another university that offered them those sorts of protections. And you don't want to see that happen, you know, whatever you feel about tenure.
If your definition of tenure and why it matters seems to be at odds with, for example, Robin Voss's thinking about tenure, has the UW done a good job of making the case for tenure beyond the borders of the university in rural and remote areas of the state and among the legislature?
So, you know, we have had some public conversations about tenure. I fully understand that many people don't, you know, if we put this up to a public vote, I don't know that I'd bet on tenure winning that vote. Folks don't understand universities very well and what, you know, freedom of expression means on a university. And I understand that it's a different sort of community. It's a community where any idea can be talked about and any issue can be debated. And that's not the way most private sector companies run, right? But it is what makes a university. So, you know, I don't disagree with you. We probably need to do a better job talking about that in the state, much less with our legislators.
Now, competition, as you said, for top faculty can be fierce, and there have already been reports of researchers and staff moving to other universities. What can the UW do to hang on to its faculty when there are competing universities who are looking to lure them away and maybe seeing this as a vulnerable time for the UW system?
Well, I'm very worried right now, and I'm worried as much because of this dreadful national publicity we've gotten, and anyone who thinks it's not having an effect on the reputation of this university isn't paying attention. It's not just national, it's international. I was at a conference last week with a number of people from around the world, and they were all coming up to me saying, oh, what's happening? I hear you got rid of tenure. We first of all got to get the right word out, and I and other leaders from the university have been trying to do that in a number of different ways. I have an op-ed in the Chronicle of Higher Education today. But we also need to get through the process once this budget is finished and we see what the final language is of putting in place the protections that are the equivalent of our peers and making sure our faculty understand that. And I will also say we've got to be a state that stops simply bashing its universities. And we've been through, you know, a whole winter and spring where the faculty have been told they are overpaid and underworked and we need to cut your budgets and, you know, we don't believe fully in what you're doing. And that doesn't help. I have faculty with lots of other job options, and they are getting those calls as a result of this national publicity. And if I'm going to keep them at this university, there's got to be some sense that there's an appreciation in this state of the quality of the University of Wisconsin at Madison and of the importance of us having the best faculty here. And I'd like to hear more of that, I have to admit, from some of our state leaders than I have.
Now, some critics have said that It's taken you a while to swing into action on this. A portion of the Board of Regents met at UW-Milwaukee in early June to talk about the issue. The state superintendent of schools was there, Tony Evers, and he wanted a motion to ask the JFC to remove the changes to tenure. You weren't at that meeting, which led to criticism from some faculty and staff that you weren't there to fight for them. What do you say to that?
So I was at the meeting on Friday, which was the official Board of Regents meeting. I was not at the committee, and, you know, unfortunately, I had some commitments out of town that had been on my books for months. I don't always attend committee meetings. As it turned out, I wished I had been at that one, but I wasn't. I promise, and I've said this to others, that I have been in touch with the regents. I've been in touch with legislators. I've been very actively involved in this debate, and whether I was or wasn't at that particular committee meeting, I think wouldn't have changed the outcome of what happened there. You know, I was very present the next day when the regents unanimously voted to, you know, put in regental statute the tenure protections that had previously been in state statute.
Now, going forward, if a majority of faculty and staff of the UW system choose to continue to fight the changes to tenure, will you support them?
Of course. I mean, I've already been supporting them with the legislature. I've been talking to people about possibly trying to get this language changed. And, I mean, this is a two-front. I mean, it would be symbolically incredibly important if we could roll back some of this very extensive language about laying off faculty. But as I've tried to indicate, you know, I've been working on that, but even if we don't get that accomplished, there are ways forward that will make sure that the faculty at this university have the same tenure protections as their peers at any equivalent university around the country. And if the first step is to say, can we change that budget language, I think that's not as highly likely at this point as I wish it was. The next step is to say, let's see what the final language is. Let's work with it to make sure we put the right protections in place.
Chancellor Blank, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Rebecca Blank is the chancellor at UW-Madison. You can read her recent piece about tenure on the Central Time Facebook page. George Wood has been a school principal for 21 years. When he recently retired, he left his staff with two words of advice: be nice. Over the years, Wood has noticed that what often impacted school kids the most was acts of kindness by their teachers. While academic challenges are important, Wood says that, quote, school should be a place where children are supported to try and try again. But Wood also says that it's become harder to practice kindness in schools. He says testing, zero tolerance policies, and even social media restrict teachers' ability to give students the extra attention they may need to get through school. George Wood is with us now after retiring as principal of Federal Hocking Secondary School in Stuart, Ohio. He's now superintendent of schools for the Federal Hocking District. He's also the founder of the Forum for Education and Democracy. George, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. It's nice to be with you.
Well, you've been a principal for 21 years, and your last piece of advice to your staff when you retired was so simple, just the words, be nice. Why do you think that's the key?
Well, I think Maya Angelou, you know, once said that people won't remember what you did or what you said. They'll remember how you made them feel. And I think young people need to know that the adults who surround them care about their success, that they do hold high standards for them. They do want them to achieve, but they're going to give them lots of support to get there. And they're not ever going to back off of that support. I think one of the things they said in the little piece was, we should teach kids that no matter how deep a hole they dig for themselves and no matter how hopeless it looks, there'll always be a teacher showing up with a shovel to help them dig out. And that's what they need to know, and that'll help them succeed.
So how does that help kids succeed? We hear about so many things, more classroom hours, more attention to detail and outside of school work. Why is just being kind going to help kids succeed?
Well, let me say, I really believe in high standards. I think sometimes when you give a message of be nice or be kind, they say, oh, you have no standards. Our high school, it's a small rural school, southeastern Ohio. We have the highest graduation standards in the state of Ohio. We require more credits for graduation than anybody else. We have a core curriculum that all our students take. All of our graduates have to perform a senior project, which is a major piece of work they undertake on their own with support from someone outside the school. And they all present a senior portfolio where they stand and deliver their work to prove that they're eligible to graduate. So this is not an argument in any way against standards, but what it is an argument for young people perform for and with people they believe have their best interests at heart. And if we can't demonstrate to that to them, they just really don't see any reason to perform for us. I think, you know, I mentioned in the piece that when I look back on my school experience, I think about the teacher who back in 1968 said, I looked a little peaked in the afternoon and I really needed to go home that afternoon so I could see the Detroit Tigers playing the World Series. I busted my rear end for her in English class every single day because she did that for me. You know, three things motivate us to perform. One is the intrinsic nature of a task. The second is fear of punishment if you don't perform. And the third is you're performing for a person who you think has your best interests at heart. Look, not everything we do in school is intrinsically motivating. The quadratic equation is not real exciting to a lot of kids. To rely on threats, which is what I believe we do a lot of, not teachers intentionally, but the system is set up to rely on threats. You know, you won't get a good grade, you can't go on this trip, you can't play on this sports team, you won't go to the next grade. You know, when the threats go away, people quit performing. But what can stay there is the engagement of a meaningful adult in your life who leads you down the path to success that you never thought you could get to. And that's why it works.
Can you give examples from your years as a principal? Did you see this playing out as you were in charge of kids and not just a kid yourself?
Well, yeah. I mean, I mentioned in this piece I was writing that I was trying to finish it up, you know, and you're sitting in your office trying to think through what do you say to the staff at the end. And a young man came in who really had given us a pretty tough way to go frequently. And he came in to tell me that he'd just got a job. And it's a good job. It's a union job. He was real excited about it. And he said, you know what? You guys just never gave up on me. So I never gave up on myself. I really thought that I could achieve because you believed I could achieve. I can tell you lots of stories like that. A young woman talking in advisory one day about how she really wanted to go on to be a doctor. And, you know, here she came from a family that didn't have a lot of means, maybe didn't have the greatest reputation. She didn't have the best test scores, so the sort of kid who normally would be ability grouped into lower classes. And then she found a high school, our high school, where we don't ability group anybody, where everybody's expected to achieve, and where we will help you get there. And when her advisor heard that story, let me tell you, a lot of resources were put behind that young woman who did go on to med school. So, you know, over 21 years, there's so many, I lose track of them. We did, by the way, Veronica, let me say, we weren't perfect. I mean, we failed plenty of times. But I'd like to believe that every time we erred on the side of kindness, not on the side of harshness or punishment. We erred on the side of looking the other way. We had a longer memory for hard work and achievement of our kids than their mistakes. And I'm afraid the system has turned so that what we remember are mistakes. You know, there's a rule in Ohio right now that if a third grade, an eight-year-old child, fails a reading test, a 90-minute reading test, that child will be retained in third grade for the next year. Number one, there's no evidence retention works. But number two, what are we teaching that child and her parents? Basically, the teachers, educators, are powerless. Because you took a test and failed, we can't do anything about it, you've got to do third grade over. Those aren't lessons that help young people grow, achieve, mature, and become the sort of neighbors we want. Because it teaches them more about us being powerless than about us being educators.
You know, one thing that's interesting about your advice to be nice is that it almost seems as though you shouldn't have to give that advice. That it used to be something that you just assumed that people would try to be nice. Do you think somehow as educators or as a broader societal thing that we've forgotten that it's sort of square one to be nice?
Well, I think if you remember that in the piece I said that what's changed, and somebody had asked me, you know, write about what's changed in your 21 years, and I think people expected me to say, oh, kids, they're a lot worse, or, oh, families, you know, they don't help, or teachers. No, those groups are pretty much what I remember for 21 years, but what has changed is it's harder to be nice. I mentioned that third grade test here in Ohio. Think about all the zero tolerance laws that are out there for kids, and if they make one mistake, they can end up being expelled from school. Think about the standardized test kids take day in and day out to decide whether or not they can go to the next grade or whether or not they can graduate, when, by the way, there's no evidence anywhere that after 30 years of testing, and a lot of people pin this on George Bush, but I tell you, it goes back beyond that to Bill Clinton, 30-some years of standardized testing and demands on kids, and no evidence whatsoever that that testing regime has closed the achievement gap, improved learning, improved schools. What it has done is it's lined the pockets of Pearson Education pretty big time, but it hasn't done anything. What has made a difference in children's lives in the school reforms of the last 20 years is smaller personalized schools, more attention to the preparation and training and support of teachers, and more attention to child welfare. Those things improve learning outcomes.
Well, if you look at something like zero tolerance, that's something that in part was put into place so kids could feel safe, that they so they'd feel empowered to learn. So if someone hit somebody else, that was it. It wasn't a second chance or a third chance, and that would deter bullying, for instance. Isn't that a good thing in some forms?
Well, I think deterring violence and bullying is a real good thing, but I think because a kid gets angry and hits a kid, that you then bring down the full force of law on them, that's just not reasonable. And I want to tell you, I think a lot of the zero tolerance laws weren't brought about because children wanted them. They were brought about because adults didn't know what else to do. They didn't want to deal with the real issue. Why do you have violence and challenges in school? They're too big. They're too impersonal. Nobody knows kids. The average high school teacher in this country still teaches 147 kids a day. How do they get to know 147 children? You know, how do you get to know their minds? How do you have the time to be nice and care about them? So what we're unwilling to do in this country, in my opinion, at this point, is deal with structural issues. Structural issues around teacher preparation, around equitable treatment of children and equitable educational resources, around the size of schools. And since we won't deal with those, we put in Band-Aids. We put in remediation at the end after the act's already occurred instead of preventing the act.
We're talking right now about how acts of kindness by teachers and administrators impact students and how our guest says they've become harder to practice in recent times. And we want to hear from you on this. Did an act of kindness by one of your school teachers change your life, maybe a second chance or even a third chance? Are you a teacher who agrees or maybe disagrees with George Wood about how it may be becoming harder to help struggling students by being kind? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about why our guests say kindness matters a lot when it comes to helping kids succeed at school. And you can join our conversation. Did a teacher's act of support impact your life? Do you agree with our guest about testing and zero tolerance policies making it harder for teachers to support kids who may need a helping hand? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us a tweet at Central Time WPR. George Wood is our guest. He recently retired after 21 years as principal of Federal Hocking Secondary School in Stuart, Ohio. He's now serving as superintendent of schools for the Federal Hocking District. And we go to our callers now. We've got David on the line in Madison. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I had a teacher in high school, and I went to high school back in the late 60s, early 70s. I had a math teacher that just made you feel like a complete idiot if you had to ask a question. And so conversely to that, I had a teacher in communications who was the only one to give me my A in 4 years of high school. I hated high school. I was into drugs. I was into everything but school. And I remember that teacher to this day. And I went on to have quite a successful career and successful marriage, and life's been really good. And when I look back on it, kindness makes all the difference. And, connecting with students makes all the difference.
Did you ever let that teacher know how much they matter to you?
Oh, yeah. Coincidentally, I ran into him a few years ago. And, man, it was just great. I mean, we gave each other a big hug. And then I was at his place, invited to his home. where I met a couple of other teachers of mine, and I said, you know, I'm sorry for being a bad kid. I was just a bad kid. And the one, my art teacher said, David, you were never malicious. You know, you always had a good heart. And it just made me feel really great.
Oh, yeah.
Made me feel good about myself.
That's a wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing that one, David. And, you know, proof in the pudding there a bit for what you're saying, George. David remembers this. You can hear it in his voice. After all these years, it really did make a difference. You think that's typical?
I do. I mean, I think teachers are incredibly powerful people in the lives of young people, or can be when the conditions are right. And I don't, let me be clear, I don't think teachers have forgotten that being nice and caring about kids is job number one, you know, in order to get them, help them learn. I think the structures are just set up so it makes it harder and harder. And so that's, you know, a little story. We had a few years ago, a family showed up with a couple of kids, and, you know, by law, I'm supposed to establish where their residence is. And I'm trying to figure it out, and it's clear it's a little shaky. I don't really know where they're living. And I decide, you know, we're going to go ahead and enroll them anyway because that's who, you know, that's who I want to be. I want to educate every kid that shows up at the door. But there's this little nagging voice in the back of my head, you know, just so you don't think I'm perfect. In the back of my head, there's this voice saying, man, if you enroll this youngster, he's a junior. He doesn't have a lot of credits. He's probably not going to get to graduation on time. And guess what? Our state report card grades us on whether or not kids get to graduation on time. I think that's important. Getting them to graduation on time is, but it encourages us not to take a chance on a young man who needed us to take a chance. It did take him 2 years to graduate. We did get dinged because he didn't graduate in 4 years, so he was rated as a dropout by our state, but he did get a diploma. We did the right thing. But I'm saying the system makes it harder and harder to do that.
I'm going to go back to our callers now. Carl is joining us next in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello, and hello to George Wood. I taught at a kindergarten in Illinois, Hubbard Woods School, that you featured in a book you had written about. And I came up under teachers. I was an assistant first, went back and got my master's in early childhood so I could teach at the school. Mm-hmm. And the whole time I was being shaped and guided by people who worked in the kind of culture and with the kind of kindness and grace and respect for children that you so rightly advocate. My concern, as somebody who's worked in teaching and supervised student teachers in the classroom, is that young people coming into the profession now have been, and those that have come in the last number of years, have been acculturated into a very different system, a skill and drill, very fast-paced, don't have time for that, you brought in a bird's nest, we're going to put it on a shelf, we'll see if we can get to it later kind of culture. And my concern is that if the political opportunity were to arise where we could move in the direction that you advocate, my concern is with those young educators who may never have seen that kind of deep engagement and careful listening and relational teaching that is so critical to helping students become not just better at math, but better people.
All right. Well, thank you for that thought, Carl. And do teachers need to learn some of this? Are we assuming knowledge? Has it always been there? And how do we maybe get back on track?
Well, you know, a shout out to Carl and Hubbard Woods. I did write about them in a book I wrote a number of years ago, and what a great place that is. I think Carl makes a great point, and that is you usually move, as adults, we move into occupations imagining them the way we experience them. Okay, so a lot of young people coming into teaching, their whole experience has been this, kids, you know, the curriculum's going to be pretty fast-paced. As he said, put the bird's nest on the shelf there. We don't have time for that when we really should have a lot of time for that. And so what it means is that young people coming into education need a lot of support around both finding models of schools like the ones we're talking about, and additionally mentoring under teachers who are those teachers who demonstrate caring and kindness. But the other piece is, at some point, I would believe that policymakers in this country would get the notion that after 35 some odd years of testing and measuring everything that moves in the school and having no real success in improvement, we would dump that agenda and get to things that really matter. The countries that succeed around the world invest heavily in teaching. They have a very much skills-based, interactive, hands-on curriculum, and they pay attention to child welfare. Those are the three things we need to do. And we could do it, by the way, because we've spent untold trillions of dollars fighting wars overseas that could go into educating our children and our teachers, and we would be better off for it.
Well, I want to thank you for that call, Carl. And George, you've mentioned a couple times that structures are responsible for some of the lack of kindness, or that there isn't time or flexibility to be kind. If you could, what structures would you change specifically to make more room for kindness?
Sure. Several things. At the lower grades, more multi-aged classrooms where teachers are with kids for a number of years, so kids have the opportunity to develop and don't have to meet a rigid, short timeline. At the upper grades, fewer classes per day for students. The average high school class right now is 42 minutes. 42 minutes a day. High school students go through 7 or 8, 9 subjects a day. They do French, then they go do biology, then they go do chemistry, then they go do algebra, maybe they do some art, then over to me. No one else experiences life that way. No one other than American teenagers experience life that way. Why do we do this to them? This is crazy. So you have fewer class periods, longer periods of time. You lower the number of students that teachers deal with every day. You institute advisory, serious advising programs where every teacher sees themselves as an advisor of students, and there is time built into the school day for that advisory work. And you institute time in the day for social-emotional programming, team building, you know, student working on, you know, you want to work on bullying in the school? You don't pass zero-tolerance laws. What you do is you build a school community, and you work with kids all the time on how they get along. I mean, school is the first big experience in our democratic society that children have with a lot of strangers.
And we leave it there. George, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Hey, thank you. It was a pleasure, and you're welcome.
That was George Wood, superintendent of schools for the Federal Hocking District. He served as principal of Federal Hocking Secondary School in Stuart, Ohio, for 21 years. He's the founder of the Forum for Education and Democracy.